the suspect that you're about to commit a crime. And I would like to call attention to the fact that an attempt to commit a crime is covered under the current statute. And I think many of the same facts that are reasonable, give rise to reasonable suspicion, you don't have to say it's about to commit a crime, but they are engaged in attempting a crime and it would survive. Anyway, I do expect to have a memorandum for you in the very near future. And I am not an attorney. I want to deny any association with that group. And I can't give legal advice, and I will have some experts on this.
These disclaimers are painful. Any questions of Ms. Remington? Starting on my far right.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Perhaps the legislative council staff or legislative staff can answer. Are there cases on the federal level relevant to Terry versus Ohio that speak to the issues that Ms. Remington just spoke about
Probably
regarding
legion.
A black individual in a white
just legion, tremendous number.
Okay, so that issue
is
already.
In fact, that particular fact is you cited or a subject of a case.
What is the, you happen to remember?
I think the bottom line result was they couldn't do it. They couldn't stop the black man from walking in a white neighborhood.
Yeah, even now, under Terry.
I'm thinking of one which
even
is.
Even under federal law.
This was, I think, an ACLU case, at least one, where this was a person who lived in the neighborhood and was jogging and had a hairdo with braids and so on and was repeatedly stopped.
So we appreciate that concern, but I think that case disposed.
Well, for the record, you might cite that under our, we adopt the Terry interpretation, which to a great extent we had adopting by inference some of that federal case law, and that case law, as Representative Baum so graciously pointed out, addresses that particular situation. Anything further? Representative Miller.
I just a question about the crummy car in the nice neighborhood.
This is your district?
It is a nice neighborhood, yes. Do you think that the appearance of the crummy car is in itself reason? Stop?
No.
Do you then have no confidence in a police officer's ability to reach that same conclusion?
Not solely on that basis. In fact, one of the cases that we won many years ago under this standard, well, it may not have been this statute, it was a traffic stop, but the police officer stopped someone in Jackson County because they were driving a very expensive automobile and had long hair and crummy clothes. The man owned the automobile, but it took us a long time, but we prevailed on that this was an unreasonable stop.
Oh. Could you speculate as to what might happen had this law been in effect in that particular case?
Not I.
Maybe the same result. Thank you.
Representative Courtney.
Do you oppose the law the way it's written now?
No. No, we support it.
I think
we'd like
that
to see you
given the
this
examples
statute.
You've given, it's very possible that a peace officer could have reasonably assumed that maybe a crime's already been committed.
That would be under the current
statute. I don't understand your questions.
You said a black man in a white neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning or some old car would give suspicion, possibly, that a crime was about to be committed. Could just as easily give the suspicion the crime had been committed. And that's the present law, correct?
Yes, but you're adding another dimension to it. It is easier to establish, in my view, that the articulable facts that lead to believing a crime has been committed than it is to argue against a motion that it was about to be committed and it was reasonable. You see the person with tools coming out of a house. That's different from saying you see someone in a car who may have tools in the car but hasn't made any motion, but you have a belief that they may be.
Well, it seems to me that if an officer were the kind that would conclude, as you suggested in those two examples, that a crime was about to be committed, they might also conclude that the crime had been committed and they wouldn't need such obvious evidence as tools.
I think you may have the same problem, but with the current statute, I think it would be better to protect against abuse.
one might point out that in all the, most all these cases cited, there was some underlying crime that was arrested for, pistols, drugs, that type of thing. So if the stop occurs and there's no contraband seized, crime in progress stopped, nothing happens. That's obvious, but I'm Representative Mannix.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since 1973, has the ACLU of Oregon restudied the its whole philosophy and position in regard to the statutory scheme in light of the 16 years of changes that have occurred in Oregon in police standards and training, to wit the requirements that we impose on communities now as to the training for police officers in terms of a gut reaction to how an officer might act? Has there been any study by the ACLU or review of that situation?
There is a review every legislative session when I have a new legislative committee and mention issues and say we've had a policy. And frequently issues are looked at again, but we don't, we, as long as a policy is in effect and has been approved by the board, it is changed only by someone moving to reconsider that policy, just as you do in the legislature.
Thank you.
That's right. That's
Thank
right.
you very much.
That's exactly right.
Dean Renfro, did I get that right?
She didn't do that, though. She's with the president. That's what surprised me.
I have to start.
This is a statutory.
I lose Dean Renfro? Okay, sorry. I'm going to have to start my cadence on no repetition. If you support the bill, tell us and then we'll move on here. Thank you, Mr. Renfro.
Chairperson Mason and members of the committee, I'm Major Renfro with the Oregon State Police Criminal Investigation Bureau. The department favors the passage of House Bill 2250. I will keep my comments restricted. To prevent additional crimes by passage of this bill, it will enable officers to prevent additional crimes by taking action and confronting individuals reasonably suspected of about to commit a crime. Now officers must delay this action until they suspect that a crime has been committed. Also, the change would provide a margin of safety to an officer by allowing him to make an inquiry before the commission of the act rather than after the crime has been committed, which oftentimes is the most volatile to the officer's safety. Also, we would request amendment to the bill to change the wording crime to offense by reading as such: about to commit a crime or to commit an offense. By this, an offense would be inclusive of infractions and violations, as well as crimes, which must be a misdemeanor or felony. That's all the testimony I have.
Questions of Major Renfro? Thank you very much. Vic Mann, Eugene Department of Public Safety.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Vic Mann. I'm a police lieutenant with the Eugene Department of Public Safety. My testimony will be only for my agency. My counsel will be reviewing this issue later, but has not had a chance to take a position on it yet. Just briefly, we would favor the bill, and many for the same reasons that the judge has mentioned, the fact that it would bring Oregon law in line with Terry versus Ohio. And one of the things that concerns us is the fact that there is only one agency that really has a charge for preventing a crime in any law enforcement scheme, and that is a police agency. The effect of the current law is very chilling on police officers. And one of the things that has not been mentioned to date, or as far as I have heard, is the fact that officers are civilly liable, both personally and as agencies, under both state and federal statute for their actions. And with the current law as it stands, an officer cannot legally take actions in situations where they're preventing crimes. The example I'm going to give you is if an officer observes a woman being followed at night by an individual, unless they, late at night, say 3 o'clock, sees a woman on the street being followed by an individual across the street, and he observes this activity for, say, 10 blocks, no other activity, but it's an area where there's been crime before. There is no articulable fact that this officer can stop that individual and make an inquiry as to what that the person who's following that woman, unless he observes a crime or an offense under current Oregon law. And if that person is doing other things in terms of ducking in and out of alleys, hiding, there really is no, there's nothing there under Oregon law that would allow that officer to make that stop. As far as the argument about gut feeling does not cut it in the courts now, never has, never will. There's a question about the attempt. Attempt is not the same as prevention. An attempt means an actual, there was co-actual action or steps taken towards the commission of a crime. It is not the same as prevention. The last comment I would make is a body of law. The state of California operates under this same law. And in fact, the case that they were talking about where one of the cases they were talking about where a black individual was repeatedly stopped, well, that was, there's a case law that where that law led, they were requiring individuals to identify themselves. And that particular law in California was thrown out. But part of it was based on the fact there were not articulable facts to justify the stop. So I think the courts have ruled in this area. There is a body of law out there. I'm also, you know, I have to say I'm a lay person, but I also am an administrator, and I face vicarious liability, and our officers are very aware of the fact that they face personal liability if they abuse the rights of citizens. And we believe the safeguards are there, and we would urge you to pass this bill.
Questions of the officer? Representative Bauman.
Could you explain again under what circumstances a police officer is personally liable instead of a government court liability situation?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bauman, under 1983 suits, federal 1983 suits, an officer, if an officer violates an individual's rights under the color of authority, the agency is responsible, and the individual officer may be personally held responsible, including punitive damages, which cannot be covered by the agency.
Further questions? Thank you very much, sir. Dale Penn. Short wrap-up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I apologize. For some reason, I had this for 1:30. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Vice President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, Marion County District Attorney. I've asked Doug Harper, who is president of the organization, to present this bill. The only comment I would make is that if we pulled the gray books down and looked on page 131, 315, I think 365, you'll see the title is crime prevention, and yet there has never been crime prevention in Oregon. That is the reason for this bill, why we would ask that you would pass the bill.
Sure. For the record, your name, please.
My name's Doug Harkleroad. I'm Lane County's district attorney and currently the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I expect to be here and seeing you in the future. Most of the points have already been made. I would suggest that it's important to bring Oregon law into compliance or the same with federal law whenever we can without doing something that bothers you people as our legislators. I'd suggest to you that this is one of those cases where you can bring them together without any deleterious effects at all. Simpler standards out in the field for police officers are better, frankly. Secondly, this allows police officers to take what is already constitutionally permissible steps to stop crimes from happening by adding that language. And I think that's a good idea. Major Renfro suggested an amendment that would add violations and infractions. That's a good idea. We require police officers now to stop people and give them citations and to stop people and cite them for various kinds of violations. And to add that, I don't think causes any problems and gives them authority in an area where they already are required to do some things. So I would suggest that. We have prepared a memorandum on stop and frisk, which I'll submit to the committee, which talks some about the law, the history of the statute, and leave that for you. We've got about 15 or 14 copies.
Questions? Go ahead.
Another point of clarification, the adding of an amendment to include offense under the federal case law, is that included in Terry versus Ohio? Are we entering into some other
maybe you can argue it, but my gut says that you've left a certain amount of the pale there. I'm uncomfortable with the amendment, to be very frank, because that exact thing. But if you want to argue it,
Terry is a crime case.
Yeah, Terry is a crime case. That's exactly my point.
And
as we know, offenses aren't crimes in this state.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Minnis, if I can respond to that, I think the basis for that opinion is that back in 1968, when this opinion was written by the Warren Court, and in 73 when it was adopted by the legislature, it was generally agreed in law that you would have the right to make a stop even if it was a violation. What happened was about 3 years ago, Justice Gillette wrote an opinion that had to do with violation cases for marijuana and stated that if you only have a violation, there can be no search, there can be no detention, and that has severely restricted the ability to make stops. And given that opinion, which just came out in the last 3 or 4 years, there is a need to revisit the area that back in 1973 it would have been given.
Are we talking then about an amendment that would be specific to offenses involving drugs?
Language proposes offenses and violations, which would include marijuana.
But want to limit offenses to just drugs offenses? You want to open the door? Are you supportive of the state police amendment?
We're supportive of that amendment because of the confusion presently in law, given the decision about the marijuana case.
You want to go to all violations and or just drug-related violations?
Representative Baum, if you use the word offense, it would apply to all crimes and all violations.
I'm trying to say that we might not want to use generically and limit it to drugs. We can't have traffic infractions and go off the deep end on this, I would think.
Certainly you could restrict the language to say crimes or
offenses related to drugs.
Right.
Yes. Would that be acceptable to you?
Certainly. Our bill would be acceptable, but any additional
Representative Baum, Baumann, I would like to hold this until work session, because
right.
I think we're getting into really the guts and the substance of it. So if I can move us a little bit.
Fine.
Okay.
My name is Sean Hoare. I'm an assistant district attorney for Lane County, and I'm actually here to testify in the joinder bill. And if not on the floor, I'll wait.
Okay. Stand down there for a moment. We're going to close the hearing on 2250. And unless I don't want to get in bad habits, but I see Representative Springer hovering in the background. Are you, or probably Senator Springer, are you here on a bill or just feeling lonely? Okay, 2251, Walter Todd on 2251. This is the joinder bill, and as we've talked about earlier, this would essentially drop the federal rule and joinder, Federal Rule 8. Rule 8 is joinder. Federal Rule 14 is relief from prejudicial joinder. And for the record, we might note that there is some established federal law on this under the model rules.
Yeah.
U.S. versus Drew, 351, Fed 2nd, 85. Pennsylvania case, Commonwealth versus Lash, 464, Pennsylvania, 573. And U.S. versus Weber, 437, Fed 2nd, 327. Just for the record on the relief from joinder. Mr. Todd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Walter Todd again. Representing the OCDLA, and the OCDLA is opposed to this bill, would basically like to respond to Ms. Streisinger's comments earlier about the argument that she has, or the position that they are taking, that this would have cost, would be more cost effective and would have less cost in the system. And specifically, she was referring to indigent defense, and I would disagree with her statement that it would cost less. I can guarantee you that indigent defense lawyers are going to be placed in a position of having to make a motion to sever these joined counts in every situation. Now, whether that motion would be successful or not, even if that lawyer knew that it would not be successful, under the current laws of post-conviction and habeas corpus in the state of Oregon, if the lawyer did not make that motion and have a hearing and adduce factual evidence about the alleged offenses, then the individual, when convicted, would file a post-conviction saying that his lawyer had been ineffective, which would not only cost more for the indigent defense on the post-conviction end of it, but also it's going to cost more at the front end of it when the lawyers are all filing the motions to sever. They're all asking for factual hearings. They're going to have to bring in the evidence, which means witnesses, at the factual hearing prior to the trial to determine whether or not severance should happen in the sense that it is prejudicial to the client. Every lawyer will be put in a position of having to come up with some reason why it is prejudicial.
Mr. Todd, let me stop you for a minute. I've done some federal criminal work, but I never did a more joinder action. Anybody know whether or not they have a lot of this in the federal system? My impression is no.
I do a little bit of federal, I'm sorry, if you're asking other people.
Go ahead, Mr. Todd.
I do some federal work, and it's been my experience that you file that motion every time.
Of course, you file every motion you can in federal court.
True, right? Yeah. But I'm talking about the motions for severance. We file those, we go up, we have the hearings, we lose, that's true. That's under the federal system. But I was just responding to Ms. Streisinger on the expense of it, the fact that it would be less expensive.
Of course, what's cheaper, a motion or a whole separate trial?
Well, I don't think that her position that a separate trial occurs in these situations is accurate. The general situation that occurs, state of the art now in Oregon, is one trial, the individual gets convicted, the DA will dismiss some of the other charges, or the individual will then plea bargain on the rest of the charges because he knows he's going away anyway. I don't think the way it is, it's going to cause any extra trials. And the other concern I have, if there is going to be a cost saving, let the DA's office make a motion for consolidation of the offenses. If the DA sees that it's going to be several trials, and most district attorneys will get a feel for that early on, they can make this motion for consolidation, have a hearing, and then if the court decides that it should be consolidated, that'll take care of the problem.
Any further questions? Mr. Representative Bowne, did you have a question? Did I go over you?
We can handle this.
Okay, we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Will Hingston, Marion County Sheriff's Association.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, again, I'm Captain Will Hingston, the Marion County Sheriff's Office, and I'm representing Sheriff Robert Winslow and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association in support of House Bill 2251. As their representative, I'd like to say that we feel that the amendment to ORS 132-560 would result in an expeditious and economic benefit to the criminal justice system as a whole. And in addition, it would not cause undue and repeated burden and stress to the victims and witnesses involved in the cases. So I could elaborate a little bit on that if you like, but that's basically what I have to say.
Any questions of Mr. Hingston? Thank you.
Nice job.
Vic Mann, Eugene Department of Public Safety.
Well done there, Miller. I like to do some command.
I've never formed
one.
Like
no.
Get used to it. Sitting here chatting.
Yeah. sits. Yeah, I don't know who's gonna, the man he sits, he's gonna kick you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Mr. Mann.
My name is Vic Mann, and I'm a police lieutenant in the Eugene Department of Public Safety. My testimony will be on behalf of my department. The Eugene City Council will be considering this bill later this month and has not had an opportunity to take a position yet. Also accompanying me is Rob Olson, who is an investigator with our department. To cut down on some of the repetitive nature of the testimony, we also will support the bill for the reasons mentioned by the Sheriff's Association. One of the things that the Sheriff's Office did not cover is we are concerned about the fiscal impact on police officers who have to appear in multiple trials. We incur costs in two ways. Either we do not have officers or investigators available for staffing, or else we incur overtime costs.
Just going to ask about that.
And that is a major overtime cost for any law enforcement agency. When you consider the fact that our uniformed officers, approximately two-thirds of them are working nights, there is no way that they can be testifying on duty. We also have a particular concern in the city of Eugene. There was an interim fiscal analysis that states some of the savings that would be gained by combining trials may be lost due to the appeals on the basis of prejudice and more defense costs because defendants will face higher sentencing in multiple cases. Arguments against the bill, I'll delete that sentence, law enforcement would argue that defendants are avoiding charges because of the cost of multiple charges. We believe that the possibility of longer sentences for multiple offenders is a positive outcome. National studies have shown that the cost of incarcerating repeat offenders is far less than the financial losses incurred by society due to the crimes committed by the offender. The Eugene Department of Public Safety is part of a research project to study the effects of increased sentencing for repeat offenders. Agent Olson, who is a coordinator for the program, is with me and available to answer questions about the program and how this bill would affect it. With provision to allow separation of charges if they will be prejudicial, there is protection for the defendant. We believe that it is only common sense that all charges arising out of one incident or one conspiracy be considered in one trial. The federal system, as has already been mentioned, does have a joinder law similar to this. And I apologize for the typos. That was my own typist in this.
Questions of the office? Representative Mannix.
Thank you. I have one question. About how often does a situation arise where you would want to see, in your own department, this joinder situation in a given year? Do you have any idea?
I would think that it's fairly frequent. My name is Rob Olson. I'm a detective assigned to the Eugene Police Department. I'm the director of a repeat offender program, which is a model program organized by the Police Executive Research Forum out of Washington, D.C. We were one of three test sites for that program. What we've done is used our police computer system to identify repeat offenders in the Lane County area, and by utilizing existing computer information about prior arrest histories, we've identified over 3,000 people in Lane County that qualify for the label repeat offender. That requires a significant crime background to qualify for that label. Of those, approximately a third have been identified as being currently active in our area. So we have a number of multiple offenders in all different crime categories that all of the research indicates that the number one impact you can have on the repeat offender is to incapacitate that individual, and our ability to bring multiple charges in a single instance would be a great benefit to that program.
Thank you. Representative Floyd, do you have a question?
Mr. Mann, you brought up the subject about the fiscal impact of testifying in multiple trials. I guess I'm going to assume that most police agencies are organized, have union contracts. Can you give us an idea, either from your general knowledge or at least from in your own particular area, about how that works? You know,
if you testify for 30 minutes, do you have to pay him for 8 hours or,
typically,
you know, all that
union
kind of
contract
stuff?
Will have a minimum. So in our department, if it's your duty day, it'll be a 2-hour minimum. If it's your day off, it's a 3-hour minimum. And that depends on how long you're actually in trial. Actually, the worst effect is that we see officers, particularly working late nights, they will spend all day in trial and then be expected to work the next day or work that night.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Dale Penn.
My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. First thing I would like to say is that this bill basically in its present form passed the House last session on a vote of 48-1. It did not receive, or it received a hearing at the last minute in the Senate, but it was not seriously considered at the time. We believe that
Representative Minnis, yes, I have, when I was in the district attorney's office.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, another question. Is it your experience that judges generally read these documents?
Well, I hesitate to answer that question.
Try for good reason.
And actually, it depends upon the judge. I would hope that they would. It's a requirement.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, follow-up question, the final question. Isn't it true that these documents are much more complex than just ready-made statements that are in a computer with two blank lines that you fill in?
Mr. Chair and Representative Minnis, no, sir, it is not. I have seen many of these, and I can go back to my office and get 10 files out right now. The first 5 pages, single-spaced, paragraph after paragraph, the officer says, I've had this training, and that takes up a page. I've gone to all these different classes. I've worked with this informant in the past, and he's done X number of things. And then the last few paragraphs, the last few pages will be, it's been my experience and training that individuals who deal in drugs have identification in their house, have other indicia of ownership, etc.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm compelled to ask several more questions just out of curiosity. Isn't it true, Mr. Todd, that the location of the search warrant changes? And the subsequent description of the place that's going to be searched changed. And isn't it true that subsequent the confidential reliable informant would change in most every case? The information that they have relevant to the reasons why it's being searched and why drugs would be located on the premise would change, and all of those facts would subsequently change. Exigency in no-knock provisions of the search warrant would possibly change. I mean, it seems to me that you're being very simple in your explanation of the construction of this affidavit.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Minnis, a lot of the officers use the same informant over and over again. So with regard to the informant issue, that's a separate paragraph. One officer, for example, who uses 5 or 6 or 7 different informants may have 6 or 7 different forms, and that paragraph will just be inserted in his lab computer. But you're right, that's potentially something that's going to change each time. As far as the address of the location, that's on the front of the search warrant itself. You're right, that's going to need to be typed in. I'm talking about the meat of the affidavit, a couple of paragraphs, a couple of long sentences to talk about how they got probable cause. That's what's inserted.
I don't want to represent Minnis.
I'm not going to continue.
We're talking shop here.
I think we are.
If not, there are no further questions.
Looking sharp.
That's it.
You guys probably do much better affidavits up there.
I used to have to handwrite mine, so.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Captain Hingston.
That's appealing that we're...
Yeah, I sure do.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'm Captain Will Hingston of the Marion County Sheriff's Office. And again, I'm here representing Sheriff Robert Trenzwell and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. As their representative, I would like to go on record in support of House Bill 2252. ORS 165-540, as it now stands, now very cumbersome to the police agency, causes a great deal of concern. for officer safety and informant safety during narcotics transactions. There is no consistency in individuals dealing in narcotics, and oftentimes there isn't time to obtain a court order or a body wire before a transaction goes down. As District Attorney Dale Penn stated, and I will echo the fact that the number of incidences where police officers who are working a narcotics transaction in a criminal investigation and are subsequently confronted with well-armed individuals has risen substantially recently. This amendment to ORS 165.40 would afford officers and informants a great deal more safety and rapid support if necessary during a narcotics transaction. Comment to, I might just take a moment to Mr. Todd's use of the reference to the computer and time lapse. Two quick comments that yes, a lot of law enforcement agencies, mine included, does use a computer and does have some of this information computerized, and it does speed up the time and that it takes and shortens the time that it takes to put together an affidavit. However, what's not taken into consideration is the inconsistency of the person that you're dealing with when you are dealing in narcotics. I personally work narcotics. I've supervised officers who are working narcotics. I'm currently in charge of the narcotics or enforcement division for the sheriff's office. And Mr. Todd mentioned the mere fact of printing out the affidavit and finding a judge. Well, a judge is not always readily available either during the day or during the working or after the working hours. It takes time to go to locate a judge to write the affidavit, and oftentimes if you took that time to write the affidavit, you would lose the transaction, subsequently the offenders and the narcotics involved.
Questions of the officer? Thank you very much, sir. Stevie Remington. Up there, you want to bring your computer?
I wish you'd had testimony. I'm Stevie Remington, American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. And I have been involved in lobbying on wiretapping and tape recording conversations every session since the 1971 revised criminal code. There have been times when the parties are so different and the language gets so complex that everyone throws up their hand. But the last time in 1985, we did come out with a reasonable compromise. I remember many, many committee meetings with then District Attorney Van Dyke of Marion County heading the others. None of us are satisfied with the current scheme, but I think it's a reasonable balancing of the interests that have shown. One thing that has never been balanced is the one mentioned earlier here, the inconsistency between the telephone call and the tape recorded face-to-face conversation. I think everyone agrees that that's ridiculous. The part where we don't agree is which way to resolve it. I think you ought to be prohibit it at, for both, and other people think you ought to permit it for both. I would like for you to look at the paragraph that is being deleted in this bill. It presently provides for tape recording conversations during any felony. That includes the specific felonies that are mentioned in the new language relating to drugs. They are already covered. It provides, yes, that you need a court order, but please notice that a court order shall not be necessary under this paragraph if exigent circumstances make it unreasonable. I'd like to urge you to keep this standard. You can wear a body wire. You can get a court order. You need not if there are exigent circumstances. It appears to me in the new paragraph B on line 26 where you have a very significant or, which is followed by the circumstances at the time the conversation is obtained, etc. That appears not to be qualified by felony. I don't know how a court would interpret a statute that says you can only get a court order for felonies. and then have another part of the statute that apparently allows it for misdemeanors. In line 40, with the new language about endangering of human life, I have no objection to that as a standard. I feel it's already covered. But again, why should there not be a requirement for a court order if you are deliberately planning to place someone in what you know to be a dangerous situation? You're sending a woman police officer in to get the goods on some pimp, and you know she may be beaten up. That's
coming up in another bill. that exact topic.
Right, and I agree.
Would you approve of that concept? I mean,
yes, but if you are planning it ahead of time, I see no reason why you can't get a court order. If it comes quickly and there isn't a reasonable time, then you've got exigent circumstances and it's permitted. But as long as you're planning it, I think you need the protection of someone looking over to see that there aren't abuses taking place.
Questions? Very much.
I have one question. And I was just looking here to see whatever happened to telephonic warrants and orders, and if there's...
I believe they're still in existence, but in my experience, they're hardly ever done. And I've asked many an officer, why didn't you ever get a telephonic warrant? And they've it's almost the culture.
I'd like to ask counsel if you could find that. I'm just looking through the reference here, not having any luck. Yeah. But if these officers could be calling a court and getting an order rather than writing up an affidavit, I'm getting a real signal.
There, I might add that there's going to be some officers going to figure out that all he needs to do really to get a body wire is to get a cellular phone, turn it on, the tape recorder on the other end, and he's met all the probably just fine. Because he's using a phone, and the phones are all right.
It's just a matter of time before somebody does that.
Thank you very much.
They're all taking notes, Mr. Chairman.
Dean Renfro.
Chairperson Mason, committee members, for the record, I'm Major Dean Renfro, Oregon State Police Criminal Bureau Commander. I, too, am wishing to speak concerning the body wire, which is the primary piece of equipment that we use. This piece of equipment serves several purposes. One, it provides accurate accounts of our transactions. It provides that measure of integrity in the investigation. And it provides the prosecutor and the defense attorney with evidence enabling an evaluation that oftentimes will avoid a lengthy and costly trial. Most importantly is the safety factor. Unfortunately, narcotics trafficking attracts the types of individuals that often arm themselves and are very dangerous to police officers. These individuals present a threat to police and individuals who cooperate with police. And as a result, we take every precaution to control the situation and provide for their protection. In these situations, the body wire is often used so that backup officers can monitor the situation and be ready to respond when the situation dictates. The body wire is used to monitor and protect large sums of money, money that belongs to taxpayers to work narcotic investigations. Under the current law, there are several problems that have occurred for law enforcement. One is the delay in starting and completing the investigation due to time required to obtain the court order. We have the largest narcotic unit in the state, including 56 officers. Not one of those officers has a lap computer. It does take probable cause to get a search warrant, and that entails considerable detail to the satisfaction of the issuing magistrate. Also, it is difficult oftentimes to track down judges or district attorneys in the middle of the night when searches are necessary. As a result of the current law, oftentimes law enforcement personnel do not utilize the body wire because of the lack of the previously mentioned benefits. Overall, passage of this bill would improve the quality and effectiveness of investigations. That concludes my testimony.
Do you have a question? Thank you very much, Officer.
McMahon and Ross Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Vic Mann, and I am a police lieutenant with the City of Eugene Department of Public Safety. My testimony today, again, is on behalf of the department. This bill is scheduled for review by the City of Eugene Council later this month, and they have not had an opportunity to take a position yet. With me and available for questions is Agent Rob Olson, who is an investigator with our department who has extensive experience with drug investigations and including the use of computers to create search warrants. Most of the points that have been mentioned before are covered in my prepared testimony, and I will not repeat those. For our department, the key is the fact that not only is this an important investigative tool, it is a safety device. We also, as a department, would like to see this restriction removed for all felonies. We believe that not only are there the same circumstances exist in drug investigations, they exist in a lot of other felony investigations. We do a lot of felony investigations around fencing operations and so forth, and we have found that basically all of our property crime ties back to drugs, and we can't predict when we're going to run into drugs and when we're just dealing with straight property crime. I would like to turn it over to Agent Olson to make some comments in response to the questions about.
Agent Olson, I'm going to limit you to about 2 minutes.
All right. My name is Rob Olson, for the record. I'm the detective assigned to the Repeat Offender Program for the Eugene Department of Public Safety. Prior to my assignment in that area, I worked narcotics investigations for approximately 6.5 years. A couple of important distinctions I think need to be made here. First of all, there's been a lot of discussion about needing a warrant and things of that nature. There's a different threshold here. We're talking about a court order and not a warrant. However, an affidavit is still required. In the area of warrants with computer technology, I think we have reduced our time from probably about 4 hours down to 2 hours in some cases. But you can imagine the amount of narcotics that can flow through the door in that kind of a time period while you're waiting to find a judge and get all the paperwork completed. The difficulties with the court order, while there is the ability under exigent circumstances to utilize the body wire, oftentimes exigent circumstances is not a good threshold because they often don't arise until you're in the middle of the undercover operation, and by then it is obviously too late to back out. Get the body wire in place on the undercover operative, and I think that could be potentially a fatal flaw in this situation. The difficulty with the court order situation, when you know in advance, is that my recollection of the statute pertaining to court orders is that you have to be able to identify the individual or individuals involved. You have to be able to identify locations and time periods. That is extremely difficult, particularly in the area of narcotics investigations, and because of that difficulty, that is one of the major reasons that the officers on an investigation in advance do not cannot make use of the ability to get a court order for a body wire.
Any questions?
I've got a practical question here.
Certainly, Representative.
It occurs to me that I'm not sure where the line is on the interpretation of attempting to obtain. Does the prohibition extend to wearing a wire, or does it extend to turning the device on? Is there a distinction that is recognized in practice? In other words, that would prevent a law enforcement officer from having a device that wasn't used as compared to having a device that was used, which would sort of fall in the line of evidence that's admissible or evidence that's not admissible.
I think that you could potentially wear a device without activating it in an investigation. However, that raises another level of safety issue for the officer if that is discovered in the event that is not being able to be utilized because the threshold hasn't been met. It's also a very difficult situation for the officers on the outside to know whether or not the device is working or whether or not it's just because the officer hasn't met the threshold to be able to turn it on, things of that nature.
I also would suspect that it would be a very difficult situation in court if it came out in court you were wearing a body wire and said you weren't operating it, and when the requirement is that you will record all conversations.
Further questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We're going to take a 5-minute recess and come back. Fine.
It'll be a matter of time. Their body wire advantage, which I'm inclined to want to give them, will get them ahead of the crime and criminals, because I can see metal detectors and everything else. I can see light.
So you can see
that. I mean, they'll come in the room and say, okay,
they got to go through this metal detector. Right?
Yeah, that's what I know. You see my app, but I'm going to tell you it's going to be this will give them advantage for a while, and then that's all right. They need to say, okay,
you. If they don't keep moving,
later on, if it's bad, then they didn't have all the
possibilities. Get members and council back into the room here. Where's Representative Miller? There's
right
Representative
here.
Miller. Representative Dennis is probably trading software. There it is. Representative Flory, where is Representative Flory?
There is
Representative Flory and Representative Mannix, the AWOL.
I've got to put these things higher. Hell.
Okay. The committee will close the hearing on House Bill 2250, 2251, 2252. Open work session. House Bill 2250, 2251, 2252. We'll start with 2250. 2250, as we already know, is the police stop bill. It seems to me that there are really two basic issues, two things we have to confront here. The first one is an amendment issue, which was proposed by the state police. And the proposal was that on line 6, after the word crime, I believe the suggested language was or offense or violation. It was that
correct.
Or was it an infraction, Representative Bryan?
It was offense.
Yes, an offense.
It was an offense.
Offense or infraction.
Yeah. Offense or infraction. I'm not particularly personally concerned with the detail of it because I, on a personal standpoint, I don't, I'm not that enthusiastic about the amendment. Is anybody, now we're going to work session on that, does anybody want to propose that amendment? Anybody in love with that amendment?
I'd like to. As I say, I want this bill to have some chance on the Senate side.
Well, it's
that's true.
Bill's going to have to be carried over by a cat.
I understand that, but that's I don't want to make it any more burdensome. You see what I'm trying to say? Wait, you understand my signal?
Yes, I realize.
Something
that Representative Miller.
We could forward at the conference.
Yeah, we could forward at the conference committee. Yeah. So I hear no motion on the amendment. Do I hear a motion on the amendment? Okay, going once, going twice, no motion on the amendment. On the bill itself, Representative Courtney.
Move to full committee.
I would like to make a comment on the bill.
He's placed motion full committee.
I'll withdraw it.
We're going to discuss it. I'm placing your motion. We're now for discussion. Representative Bauman.
Sorry, Representative Courtney. I understand now what you did. I have a couple of concerns. My first concern is that reading interpretations of our statutes in Court of Appeals reports can be kind of nightmarish, and I'm worried about the Judiciary Committee handing over language like is about to commit a crime to be practiced out in the field and then translated for practitioners by the Court of Appeals. I'm concerned that we don't establish any kind of criteria, or that our discussion really hasn't clarified very much what our thinking is about what the limits are on that translation of behavior by a police officer. And my other concern is, if there is a concern about liability insurance in 1983 offenses right now with the current standard, wait till we get into the interpretation of about to commit a crime and 1983 offenses and liability insurance concerns. So I'm not sure that we aren't digging a hole for ourselves and really for law enforcement, in addition to increasing an already heavy burden on the Court of Appeals by going into this. Now, I'm still curious. There was a little bit of a discussion about attempt and substantial steps, constituting substantial steps toward the commission of an offense, constituting the offense of attempt whatever, which is a crime which can be reasonably suspected of having been committed under current statute. That's one concern. My other concern is, I think this discussion of war and offense is interesting, and it seems to me that some of the problem with the stops with regard to marijuana use, which is currently an offense, could be resolved if we entertained an amendment to omit the new language on line 5 and 6 and inserted or an offense.
Now, do you make that as an amendment?
I only propose that for the discussion of the committee. If the chair wants an amendment, I'll propose that as an amendment, although I still, I'm not sure I would support it as an amendment.
Well,
I'm just proposing to those people.
She wants to discuss it.
Concern, I don't, Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to do is be accommodating. I see a gigantic problem in terms of legal interpretation of language that we're inserting. And if the problem that has been presented to us today has more to do with whether what we're witnessing is an offense or a crime as being the threshold for the stop, the committee feels that way, then I would propose that the committee discuss the amendment that I just quoted, but I'm not going to move it.
Same bound.
The discussion, what's your pleasure? Representative Fuller, anything? Brian? Minnis? Representative Minnis, any comment?
I have a question to Representative Bauman. Perhaps I don't understand where the confusion is with regard to the Court of Appeals in the state of Oregon and where they would lack any basis of information for any understanding of what standards would be set, since in my limited training there have been cases on a federal level since the Terry versus Ohio case that have substantially drawn limits and standards and lines for police officers, and there are standards throughout the nation where they're trained. I guess maybe I need to understand from your perspective where the Court of Appeals is going to create a problem for that issue.
I think it would be a problem, Representative Minnis, and it's conjecture, and I conjecture that it would be a problem. I suppose it's possible to conjecture that it would not be a problem, and then the problem in front of the committee is whether we don't, as members, need to resolve that speculative kind of philosophy about writing laws and putting them on the books before we pass them out.
Sure. Representative Courtney?
What's the case law on the about to commit in terms of the actual steps?
Basically, you're about to adopt a Terry standard, U.S. versus Terry 392 U.S. 1. And again, as the prior language I quoted to you,
That was my understanding. Yeah.
That's the kind of the case law pigeonhole you're stepping into or something. I don't know how comfortable the committee is with that. I think Representative Bowden is uncomfortable with it. I'm comfortable with it. From a personal standpoint, if I might argue this, I'm very uncomfortable with the addition of the word offense and violation. I just think that's just too broad. But as long as it does indeed say crime, the reason why I'm particularly attracted to this is that this is, and it sounds almost rhetorical, but I think there's a little truth to this is a crime prevention bill. And given that, I'm going to support it. Now, I don't want to monopolize the discussion. Do we have any further discussion? Representative Mannix, I think you know we're working 2250.
I mean, with apologies, one phone call turned into much too much. I'm learning my lessons about these breaks. I understand Representative Baumann has expressed some concerns about the ramifications of this. I didn't hear her comments, so I don't think it's appropriate for me to try to respond.
Any further discussion on this matter before I call the roll, or I have the roll call? Not. Representative Courtney has moved House Bill 2250 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation unamended. The clerk, he's ready. Always gets the clerks in the way. We'll call the roll.
Baum?
Yes.
Baumann?
No.
Bryan?
Aye.
Clark?
Not on this.
Yes.
Mannix?
Yes.
Miller?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Glory.
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 Aye.
And Representative Mannix?
I'm not on the subcommittee.
Oh, that's right. Oh.
You can vote so we can make it to the full committee. No.
Yeah, you'll get it. 7-1. The bill is sent to the full committee. Representative Mannix, you've been so good. I'm going to let you carry that in the full committee.
I would be honored.
Right?
I would be honored.
Oh, man. Okay. House Bill 2252. Is the, I'm sorry, House Bill 2251, let's get this in the right order, is the joinder statute here. On a technical level to start with, I believe there was a necessity for an amendment on line 11. Is that right? And the insertion at line 11 should be the deletion of the term, three words, indictment or information, the deletion of those three words, and the inclusion of the two-word statement, accusatory instrument. That's a fairly technical amendment, and I would ask that that be submitted to the committee. Is there any objection to that amendment? No objection.